Welcome to Light from the Black Box, a podcast from Sheen Center for Thought and Culture. I'm Valerie Smaldone. Sheen Center is embarking on a very exciting journey, presenting its first originally produced theatrical play, Nine Circles, written by Bill Kane and directed by Kent Nicholson. It's a dramatic and powerful thriller. A little bit about this play making its New York premiere at Sheen. Nine Circles is inspired by actual events. A soldier is arrested and prosecuted for acts that he may have committed while serving in the U.S. Army during the Iraq War, based on the Nine Circles of Hell in Dante's Inferno. Playwright Bill Kane was founding director of the Boston Shakespeare Company and has written for House of Cards and Bloodline. I asked Bill how it felt to have this play produced for the first time in New York at the Sheen Center.
I was surprised that anyone ever wanted to do this play. Wasn't written for anyone. In some ways, it wasn't even written for production. The story I found so compelling that as it began to come together in the newspapers of the time, when I found this guy who had committed war crimes, had during basic training gotten himself baptized, that began to catch my interest. And then later on, when I found out that he had gone to see a shrink trying to stop himself from war crimes, I thought, this man is a hero. But I never thought the play would be done, frankly. I was writing out of the desire to tell the story, the desire to understand the world and the craziness of a world in which the one person trying to stop the war with all of his effort had a moral genius that the governance of the country did not have. Now, when the Sheen Center, when Bill made it clear that he wanted to do this play, I was truly astonished. Because it's not an easy play, it's a demanding play. And I suppose as we talk, we'll try to make it sound audience-friendly and all of that, and it is, but it's a challenging journey. But the thing that I was affected by was the subtitle of the Sheen Center, Thought and Culture. I want to be in a place where we are reinventing culture, which we very much need. And if we could do that a little bit with each of our shows that all of us do, I think that would be a life well spent.
I read that when you were a little boy.
Oh, dear.
You saw.
I don't remember. It was a long time
but
ago.
But there's a good reason to ask this question, because you were affected by a movie that your parents brought you to see. And the movie was about good and evil and brutality. And what movie was that?
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I remember as a child, I think it was the first movie I ever saw. I remember being taken into a room and suddenly there was this enormous picture. I had to have been very, very small. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I was thrilled with all the dwarves riding all the friendly forest animals to kill the witch, which I thought was great. Ah, great, the witch is dead. But in growing up, this Pelagian version of the world in which good and evil are two opposed forces, and good must destroy evil, and somehow by destroying evil, you aren't destroyed yourself, you don't become evil, continues to strike me now as not a helpful paradigm for the way to live. So part of what Nine Circles is about is a different paradigm, and that's Dante. You journey through hell, purgatory, to reach paradise finally, but it isn't a battle, it's a journey, and it isn't good against evil. It's everything conspiring to arrive at the center. And the center is the love that moves the universe. And even in this play, I don't know what Kent would say about this, but even in this play, that's the drive, the move towards the love that moves the universe.
Kent Nicholson is the director of Nine Circles. He's directed the play before. So I asked him if anything new bubbled up for him, or if he received some enlightenment directing this new production at Sheen.
In this process, we're figuring out what the play has to say to us now. I mean, any great play is going to not just be a product of its time, but also be able to sustain itself over longer periods of time. And I believe this is a great play, but that's the challenge, is reinventing it for the world we live in now. The last time I worked on it was 2010, and we're in a very different spot in terms of our relationship to the Iraq War specifically, but to these events and to our idea of who we are as a nation. And so trying to figure out how this piece speaks to us now it is even different than how it would have spoken to us even a year ago mm-hmm. at this point. So that's the exploration now. I don't know that we have 100% of the answers now. That's done in conjunction with the actors and what they each specifically bring to the table and to their roles. And I think in the long run, the piece is very different than it was when we first did it. It's playing very differently. We can't really rely on any of the things that we created before, although they inform us. But I think it's important that we make the changes and let the piece be as fresh as it can be.
Also with that, on the first time you do a play, you don't know if it will fly. You just
right.
don't know.
Right.
You know, you have a hunch that it might work, but you honestly don't know what you're dealing with. So this time coming through, we know that the theatrical machine that any play is will support the actors. And so this time, I think we're able to hear more of what the characters are like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're getting a chance to dig into the event more. Last time the event was, can we get it up on its feet and do the play and can people watch it?
Yeah, and this time the event is much more, what are we saying to this audience in this time, in this city, in this neighborhood, in any given night?
Bill, let's talk about the meat of the play. You said what prompted you to write the piece, this mm-hmm. article that you had read and the unfolding story, and the nine circles. If somebody knows nothing about this time where this particular character, this event that happened, they don't know Dante, how would you describe how the play unfolds?
Well, I wouldn't. I would say, come see the play, because I think each play is an event. Each performance of a play is an event. So come see it and be exposed to it. The play got written in a very odd way. I rarely, that is to say, never write anything in chronological order. I mean, in the order in which the scenes occur. But with this one, it wasn't an article. It was a series of newspaper articles. There was a New York Times article about this horrific war crime that occurred. Then later, there was an article about the young man, the 19-year-old who committed the crime. And I thought, this bastard, you know, I mean, these horrible things. Then in Basic, another article comes out, he was baptized. And then as the articles begin to come out, it becomes a much more interesting story of a person. So at a certain point, I forget exactly where it was, I was between projects and I sat down and I wrote the first scene pretty much exactly as it is. And instead of calling it scene one, I wrote circle one on the top and sent it to my agent. Now, my agent always calls me right back and says, just got the script, loved it, all of that. She's great, Beth Blickers. But in this, there was no response. So I called her up a couple days later and said, didn't you get it? And she said, yeah, I got it. And I said, well, what's going on? She said, well, I'm waiting for circle two. And I began to churn them out one after the other as the circles developed. But the impulse to write circle one on it, I don't know where it came from. And I'm not a Dante guy. I'm a Shakespeare guy. And Eliot says the world is divided into Shakespeare people and Dante people. So I sat down and read the Divine Comedy in a day, and then read it the next day. It's a short piece, actually, and then read it day after day after day and was astonished by the paradigm shift, by the journey. And that then informed the creation of the play.
You can't have a challenge as a director with this piece to bring it to life with the actors, with the stage, with the set. Initially, one would say this is just a heinous character. I have no sympathy for this man. What he did was unforgivable.
Mm-hmm.
But the transformation takes place.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically at the very last piece of it, I am so curious to see how that is directed. So if you can just shed some light on how you have or how you are currently working with the gentleman who's playing Reeves.
Josh Collins.
How do you provide him with context in this long journey through this short play?
Well, it's mostly about moment-to-moment work and what the story is. You know, in a way, an answer to your question about what would you say to somebody who was coming to see it, I mean, the truth is, as we don't know that much about the character when the play starts. You learn it as the play goes on. And there's a question of, did he do it? Did he not do it? So when does that penny drop? So, you know, how you've most of us already make up our minds about characters and people when we first meet them. So we don't know. These are not necessarily things that we know as the play begins. Hopefully, his humanity is what's on stage. And so his humanity gets mixed up inside of what the acts that were committed are. And we do go then, I think, beyond this idea of good and bad, this dichotomy that we seem to have created.
Mm-hmm.
And you hope for something for this guy. You see him reaching for it. You see him striving for it. And what gets in his way and why he's not allowed to have it. And I think those things can't help but affect you, as well as understanding what he did, which is a real thing. And then at the end, it does become a moment of empathy, not necessarily us for him, but him for his victim. And if the audience can feel that, then I think we've done what we need to do.
Yeah.
Because then that allows us to see him as redeemed as mm-hmm. well. But that's hard. That's a hard ask. It's a really hard ask in our society where those dichotomies are very, very real. And where we, I think, sort of suffer the consequences of it on a daily basis in major and minor ways.
Tackling this type of content, you talk about the healing power of the arts. And sometimes I feel that that is the only thing that will help us. I personally feel that without music, without art, without theater, without dance, I don't know how society could continue. Tell me about your thoughts on that, Bill, the healing power of the arts.
The healing power of the arts. Well, when you work in arts, it doesn't feel healing. You're tired all of the time. Your socks are dirty. Whenever I finish writing something, I can tell I'm always in dirty underwear. My socks are torn and I haven't been out of the building in a while. So no, I don't think the arts heal. Or if they do, they destroy first. I think we want to be together. In spite of the terrible divisions that are going on now that make me dread getting up in the morning, I think at base, we want to be together. The interesting thing is democracy and theater grew up together, and now they're separate. Democracy and theater both took place in the same place, a big bowl where people came together. And the original stories that were told in Greek drama, the theory is from this wonderful book, Theory of War, that the theory was, because the plays are all about war, and everyone in the audience were citizen soldiers, that it was a way to process the trauma of war. So yeah, I think there's a deep reaching, at least there should be a deep reaching in the arts. No, I don't even mean that. I think even silly stuff, even nonsense, brings people together and lets us be together. At its best, it challenges us to always widen the circle of inclusion. And that certainly is what this play is about.
When I heard about the play, there was just an incident that happened, of course, with the shooting in Fort Lauderdale. A soldier went to people in Alaska saying, "I need help." And after 3 days, they released him. So there's that piece of this that is also very, very important to the play, that he did, in fact, ask for help, and nothing really came of that story. This is a very dense piece that you've written. Do you ever write comedy?
What a mean, terrible woman. Who is this woman? Is she a friend of yours? I don't understand this. The play's funny. The play is a very funny play. I've never written anything that isn't funny. Is that true, Kent?
I think that's true.
You know, one thing that was said, I wrote a play about my family, and Kent directed that at South Coast Rep and Seattle Rep and someplace else.
Berkeley Rep.
All the reps on the West Coast. But my favorite review said, it's talking about weeping. And it says, "We weeping, 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 and oh, it's tearing my heart out." And then the line said, "By the way, did I mention it's also fucking funny?" I think that's my favorite review. I think theater is, I don't know, I think there's a line in the play where Reeves is asked, "Do you think this is funny?" And he's talking about a dog. He says, dogs think everything is funny.
Yeah.
And I think any play that isn't also funny, I'm not a big House of Bernard Alba guy, where everything is very, very dark. My paradigm is Shakespeare. I ran a Shakespeare company for 7 years. Would you like me to recite The Tempest or Twelfth Night? I'll spare you that. But in that, you're always going high and going low. And if you're playing in the middle, you're kind of missing it. But King Lear is a very funny play if done properly.
Yeah. Also, the comedy is necessary. I mean, I've come to feel pretty strongly in my own work that if you don't have the comedy, at least somewhere in there, then you don't earn the seriousness.
Yeah.
You know, you don't earn the emotion. The comedy is part of what opens people up to the entire experience, right? And life is absurd. You know, it really is. Life is at its best hysterically funny, even when it's deeply painful. Some of the most painful things I've ever gone through are also some of the funniest.
Well, when my mother, dying of cancer, and this is one of my favorite stories, and I've exploited her death for commercial gain in a play, I was in the bedroom writing something, and my mother was moaning in pain. And I came running out from the bedroom and said, Mom, what's wrong? She was bent over and holding her back, and she said, oh, my God, Billy, I'm in such pain, and the Knicks are down by 3. and it struck me as kind of perfect.
Right.
The stuff that's funny isn't written in as relief. It's written in because a character realizes the absurdity of his position. At one point, he says, will you represent me to a lawyer? And the lawyer says, the government will appoint a lawyer for you. And he says, wait a minute, who wants me dead? And she says, well, the government. And he goes, well, that isn't good. But all the way through, this young man is trying to put together in his own understanding a way to understand his own life. And another lawyer says to him at a certain point, would you like people to understand what you did? And he says, I would like to understand it. So he's a very smart young man trying to put together an understanding of a horrific event. But wait a minute, let's back up, because we're not telling the truth. Not really.
Okay.
Because the play really is not about the horrific event.
No.
Strangely, that's the plot. The story is really, the heart of it is in a different place. Do you want to take this?
No, you can.
I think life is about connection. I think just beyond the formalities of our life and the rituals that we use to get through the day, there's a tremendous compassion that wants to be released between us and among us. And I think theater does that and ritual does that. Well, in war does that too. War can release a sense of brotherhood and a sense of intimacy that I see in my own brother who went to war. And that warriors seem to feel for one another. And this young man, who had everything going against him growing up, has an experience in war of a heart-opening and soul-opening experience where his body and soul make contact with another soldier, a superior officer, a sergeant. And that explosion of soul, not the crime, it's the explosion of soul within him, that he doesn't know what to do with. And that's what the play's about. Can he find his way back to the depth of his own soul and the intimacy that he experienced on the battlefield? And a crime is involved, but the true story is his attempt to get back to a moment when he really understand who he was in the presence of a sergeant who was a real man.
Well done. We went very deep there. So I appreciate that. Thank you for bringing us. And you've continued to write for years and years. You're doing television. You write your own plays. What attracts you when you write? What are you looking for? What are you trying to solve for yourself as a writer?
Kent, would you take this one?
I can't quite speak for you on that one. Quelling the voices in your head, maybe?
The terrible, terrible voices. Let's see. What am I looking for? I don't look for something. Plays find me. Here's what happens, and I know I have a play. I'll be walking down a street, and I'll hear something, or I'll be standing someplace and see something. and I will be unable to move and sometimes have to hold onto a building or drop to my knees. And it's an emotional event that's like a stabbing, but a good stabbing, a thrust that goes through me.
Talk about that moment for equivocation.
The newspaper articles were that for this, when I realized he went to see the shrink. But equivocation, I'm a Shakespeare guy, and I was spending a lot of time in London. I'd been teaching in the South Bronx and was very tired, so I went to London for 2 weeks, not looking to write a play. And I went to the Globe Theater and loved it and was moved by it and was just relaxing. But then I went to the Tower of London, and one of the things I am is a Jesuit priest. And in the Tower, Jesuits were imprisoned and went into a cell. And in the cells of several of the towers, people who were imprisoned there in the 1600s engraved their names and the messages they wanted to leave before they died. And because they were carving in stone, these messages were short. And I saw there are a number of Jesuits, but I walked in and saw Henry Walpole, S.J., for the greater glory of God. And this is a brother of mine who died in the Tower of London for his faith. And more than for his faith, in an attempt to take care of people who were his brothers and sisters. And when I saw it, I put my hand on it and I dropped to my knees and I just started to cry. And the reason was, Shakespeare at the time was at the Globe churning out thousands of words and getting very well paid for it. And he was writing in the support of a corrupt regime. He was supporting corrupt wars. He was supporting a king who was doing religious persecution. And on the rack in the Tower, there was a sign that says, "No one has ever been tortured in the Tower of London because of religion," which is just a flat-out lie. And here in stone was truth, somebody's name, saying, "Look, I'm trying." And I thought, look, which would I rather be? Would I rather be Shakespeare and own the biggest house in Stratford, or a prisoner of conscience carving a word into a wall in a cell? And that moved me. And that turned into a play called Equivocation about Shakespeare trying to deal with his own moral ambiguity at the time. But so plays find me, and this guy, based on a real guy now dead, hanged himself in prison. This precious guy, this guy who had nothing going for him, although that's a condescending thing to say, but who certainly had to fight against the odds, found a moment, maybe several moments, when light came out of him and truth came out of him. I believe the goal of writing in my life is to show people their hidden greatness, which they cannot see. And if they could, they would be able to see it in others. And I saw that in the cell, and I certainly saw that in this guy.
It's interesting, too. I think, just jumping off of that and talking specifically about Nine Circles and this notion of hidden greatness, when you think about the crime, which we're very specifically not talking about, it doesn't excuse or forgive or gloss over or not deal with the play, this crime. The character is punished for this crime. The character is forced to see the crime. The character is forced to feel the crime in a way that hasn't before. And that's part of the hidden greatness of the character. The character it reveals that dichotomy upon which we view the world. This is not a character who you would hear a description of and go, "Well, he's filled with hidden greatness." But it's in those moments where that is revealed that we see the potential that has in part been lost. And that's the tragedy of the play. That's the tragedy of our world, is that we don't allow people to fulfill that in some way. And I think that's part of what this play reveals. It's important to recognize, I think, because we do tend to think in dichotomies, that this play is not excusing the crime,
not at all,
or ignoring it. In fact, it deals pretty explicitly with it. So that is in fact not the point, right? But it is in point of fact, if you're going to say that everybody has that potential within them in some way, or from a Jesuit standpoint, looking at the moments where you can point to God and say, that's God too, in this character would be the least likely place you would be able to find it. And yet that's part of what the play reveals to you.
But that's what being a Jesuit means. You know, looking for God in all the wrong places.
Right.
You know, it's to find the presence of God that hasn't been discovered.
Right.
And that's what our training is. I mean, and that's what we do.
Well, and that's something that I think theater can do.
It's what theater does as well, right? Willie Loman, you know, I mean, it's the lost. I mean, like one thing that gets said in the play, the character, when he's talking to the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist says, I forget what she says, but he says, look, anybody can feel sympathy for the good guy. He doesn't need your sympathy. He's got a wife and child for that. But I'm the one, you know, I want to kill everybody here. What about me? And there's something to be said for that.
Right.
I'd like to bring in Bill Riley into the conversation, executive director of the Sheen Center.
Absolutely not.
This is your first original production at Sheen. Congratulations.
Thanks.
But I must ask you, why this play and why now?
Well, for a lot of reasons. One, I've never read a play that I think is more about what the Sheen Center is than this piece. It's hands down the best anti-war play I've ever read. But as Bill said earlier about moving to the center of the universe where love is at the end of the day, at the very last piece in this play we get to. And finding God in spaces that you ordinarily wouldn't think that he is also at the core of why we're doing this. But as a center for thought and culture more than anything, I think, you know, this play was written and takes place in 2006. And here we are 11 years later, and in some respects we're still there. War is hell, and I think that this is a great opportunity for us to explore what goes on, not only in war, but at the same time, what's going on in America today. And it's extraordinary that, you know, this piece is not only as well written as it is, but I think that it's got a tremendous cast, and I think it's going to cause a lot of people to think. And this is a place where we like people to think and to question and to surprise people.
It surprised me, I have to say. Reading the play, I had heard that it was a bit brutal and a bit shocking.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, I get it. So on your website, it says strong language.
Yeah.
Was there any pushback in producing this or any concerns that you had?
Sure. Because, you know, this is a play that's going to surprise people, but it's also a very, very important play for our time. None of the language is gratuitous. If it were gratuitous or if it were sloppy writing, I would have a problem with it, but none of it is. It's exceedingly well written, and it's, you know, we're talking about folks speaking in war and in the army, but most importantly, it's genuine and it's real, and as I say, none of it's gratuitous.
What are you hoping to happen after this first original production here at Sheen?
Two things. One is I think that to be able to let people know that we're looking for playwrights like Bill Kane, that we want to do pieces that force people to think and question, and at the same time, at the end of the day, to be able to realize that we're a place where not only we are surprising people, but at the same time, at the end of the day, we're trying to do, you know, what Bill said earlier about showing people that art is a place where not only you can surprise people, but at the same time, where you can force them to dig deeper.
You mentioned, Bill, about the country where we are now. There's no way around it. The country's been divided. It's been a very difficult time for us here. Any thoughts about how this can help us to understand each other a little bit better?
I think fundamentally the play is about empathy.
Yeah.
And if we're going to come together in any way, shape, or form, then we all have to have a little of that. And what we're really watching is the journey of a guy who feels no empathy travel to a point where he has to feel empathy. And that's sort of the crisis of the play, is he feels something for somebody and he is desperate to get back to that place. So, you know, I think that's part of the audience's position as well, watching somebody who we would normally think of as a monster and trying to find a point of empathy for his situation. Again, that's breaking down dichotomies, but it's also forcing us to recognize all of our own humanity and what that might mean. And I think an exercise in that, in the theater, is probably going to be as good an exercise for people who confront people of different beliefs anywhere, you know.
There's also the macro question, and I want to be delicate with this because I want to have empathy. I think I want to have empathy. It's entirely possible I don't want to have empathy. It's also the crime that's discussed within the play that provides the plot of the play, if not its soul, takes place in the context of a larger crime. And the larger crime was a war of choice. And this war of choice was the result of bad policy, anger, fear, revenge, a whole bunch of terrible things. So it also calls that into question. And my question for myself these days is, do I want to feel empathy for that? If someone is, in fact, if somebody got up and said, let's start the Iraq war, where would I be? And the answer was, at the time, I'd be in the street. So it also calls that question, the question of national policy. Mm. And right now, I mean, right now, as every day, there's another outrage in terms of what national policy is becoming, that it's coming from, it seems to me, places of racism and anger and self-protection and
fear,
one after the other. This kid was right in the middle of that, and he was a victim of that. And I think the people who did that need to be held accountable, and they weren't. He was. He's dead. He was put in prison, and he was killed. Now, what he did was so much less than what the country did in terms of body count, in terms of size of destruction, in terms of tonnage of weaponry. It also calls that question. And my question for myself is, where does my empathy come in there? Because I get caught up in the dilemma then, because I feel rage and I feel anger and I feel like righteous and a lot of stuff that isn't in the long run going to help. And I don't know what to do with it. So the play also calls some of those questions.
I think the other thing that we haven't talked about in regards to the play is some of the structure of it. I mean, you know, we have one character who has a name, and then every other character is army lawyer, pastor, defense lawyer. You know, they're all representative in some way, shape, or form of institutions. And do our institutions serve us? And how do they serve us? And I think that's actually another question that the play is sort of asking by extension.
And within the play, this guy uses them to find his way home, kind of. So maybe that's my hope for myself.
Bill Kane, I want to give you the last word in the podcast.
Finally, I knew someone eventually would give me the last word.
Given your calling, given your...
What would you call my calling?
Your calling as a priest, as a Jesuit, and I'm a Fordham University grad.
Oh, good.
So I have a great special place in my heart. Given your artistic background, if you had the opportunity to speak to the real character upon which this story was based, if you had the opportunity to visit him in prison, what would you have said to him?
That's actually not as hard as I thought was coming, because I think it'd be very easy. Hearing confessions in prison is an extraordinary thing. And I can think of many times when talking with someone, whether or not it had an actual confessional form or not, I can think of one particular time where I was talking to a young man who had committed murder, and he was in terrible pain. Terrible, terrible pain over what he had done. And sitting there, all I could tell him was, the pain that you're feeling is a sign of your greatness. The pain that you're feeling is a sign that you're yearning for something more. The pain that you're feeling, which is vast and intense, because the crime is vast and intense, is a sign that your soul is enormous. What's happened in the past is the past, and it is not your future. And it is not your totality. I do not believe that the deepest thing in you or anyone is your darkness. I think we confuse darkness with the absolute depth, but I think under your darkness there is light, and I think you are moving towards it. And in hearing this particular kid's confession, I could see he was feeling it. He was feeling what I was saying, and it was news to him. And at that moment, I sat there and thought, you know what I feel like? I feel like Christ. And you know what this kid is? This kid is Christ. And for a moment, in this extraordinary moment of the ritual that very much like theater is the ritual of religion, I felt like love was all in all, and the presence of Christ was all in all. So were I in the presence of Stephen Dale Green, rest in peace, that's what I would tell him.
Bill Kane, author of Nine Circles, playing at Sheen Center through March 19th. Thanks to Bill Kane, director Kent Nicholson, and executive director at Sheen Center, Bill Riley. I'm Valerie Smaldone.
Light from the Black Box is a podcast series produced by the Sheen Center for Thought and Culture, Valerie Smaldone Media Worldwide, and Culture Sonar.